Hi, this is Arnie Arneson, and this is the Friday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. As you know, we begin our show by always finding something to read or talk about. On today's show, I'm going to continue to sort of slog through Ann Nelson's fabulous piece at the Washington Spectator about Project 2025, which she entitled The Latest Plot Against America. We're, believe it or not, up to installment 7. This is what she has written. Project 2025 is actually the opening salvo of the 2024 presidential transition project. The comprehensive 900-page playbook was produced under the auspices of the Heritage Foundation and supported by over 100 partners. It's officially entitled Mandate for Leadership, the Conservative Promise. Project 2025 lays out specifics for hundreds of policy objectives affecting every area of public life, from women and the LGBTQ populations to environmental regulations to the concentration of power in the executive branch to promote an authoritarian regime. Here is part 2 of the 5th of 10 things you need to know about Project 2025. She actually sort of took 10 major areas and then sort of wrote about them. But even within the 10 areas, she sort of compartmentalized. And so we're looking at the section entitled Public Health. The recommendations concerning health are dispersed among the introduction and various chapters. This is the part that still blows my mind, who wrote these chapters. Now just think about these individuals and understand what their agenda is. Together, they argue for an abandonment of the government's role in promoting public health for American children and adults. The author of the foreword is Heritage President Kevin Roberts, and the chapter on the Department of Health and Human Services is Roger Severino, a former Trump appointee who previously served as the director of the DeVos Center at the Heritage Foundation. His wife is a CNP member, Carrie Severino, who clerked for, oh my goodness, Justice Thomas, and currently heads the Judicial Crisis Network, which coordinates efforts with Leonard Leo on federal court appointments. I mean, this thing is so freaking insidious. But now we get to the new content about Project 2025. And this is what she writes. Not surprisingly, Severino's first stated goal is to protect the fundamental right to life. Goal number 4. Preparing for the next health emergency codifies COVID disinformation, such as the claim of excess deaths due to lockdowns, totally untrue and not proven, and seeks to disable the Centers for Disease Control's ability to advise the public on measures for disease control. The COVID-10 pandemic demonstrated how catastrophic, this is a quote from Project 2025, quote, the COVID-10 pandemic demonstrated how catastrophic a micromanaging, misinformed, centralized, and politicized federal government can be. Basic human rights, medical choice, and the doctor-patient relationship were trampled without scientific justification, and for extended periods of time, excess deaths, not due to COVID-19, skyrocketed because of forced lockdowns, isolation, vaccine-related mass firings, and colossal disruptions to the economy and daily rhythms of life. Unaccountable bureaucrats like Anthony Fauci should never again have such broad, unchecked power to issue health guidelines that will certainly be the basis for federal and state mandates. This is a quote from Project 2025, and this is how Ann Nelson translates it. Quote, excess deaths, not due to COVID-19, skyrocketed. Let me explain to you folks, that never, ever happened. But, why quibble about details? I mean, understand what is in here. Understand their response to the pandemic. Understand what they're threatening to do. It is so, so terrifying. I was talking to Bill Curry, and Bill Curry will be coming on with us later with Harold Meyerson last night. You know, and Bill said, well, you know, the Republican Party isn't going to even, like, have some kind of a public agenda at the Republican National Convention. And I said, they don't need one. They don't need to put out what their proposals are, because as you and I both know, they have now privately outsourced the public agenda for the Republican National Committee to what? To the Heritage Foundation. Everything is now private. Nothing is public. And when we keep thinking, oh, well, they're not, you know, whatever Trump wants. No, it's not even whatever Trump wants. They've written it down, and it's 900 pages long, and it is incredibly extensive. We didn't grab Scott today, but I wanted to talk a little bit about what I know he was going to be talking about. And one of the things I thought was interesting was the Time magazine has picked their 100 most influential people of 2024. And guess who is one of the most influential people? Governor Greg Abbott. And here's how they framed it and how they described him. To the frustration of his political rivals, Greg Abbott is a talented room reader. During his 9 years as the governor of Texas, he has proved adept at simultaneously throwing red meat to his conservative base while tempering pushback from the state's liberal enclaves. All the while, he has masterfully needled Washington through both unending legal challenges and agitating stunts, such as sending buses of migrants to Democratic cities. Despite some glaring missteps, including his handling of an ice storm that snowballed into an energy crisis, and initially praising the calamitous police response to the Uvalde school shooting, Abbott remains one of his party's most persuasive pitchmen, especially on immigration, where he's constantly pushing at the boundaries of what states can do on enforcement. Whether Donald Trump wins or loses this year, Abbott is among the contenders best positioned to eventually pick up the MAGA mantle. I was talking to Bill Curry last night, and I was talking about who really has set the immigration agenda has been Governor Greg Abbott. I mean, he's brought all these Republican MAGA governors down to the border. We know that, for example, New Hampshire and Iowa and a number of other states are sending National Guardsmen down to the border. He's flipped the bird to the Supreme Court about their rendering about who should, in fact, be controlling this issue. And I said, so he really is the one who has defined the immigration and border issue for the Republican Party. And Bill Curry said to me, no, that was Donald Trump. I said, no, Donald Trump sort of uttered something, but what Governor Abbott has done is he has defined it. He has elevated it. He has used it as a major threat. He has brought all the Republican governors onto his side about this issue, whether immigration was an issue for them or not. So understand the power of what he is able to do. And I also want to remind everyone that not only has he been sort of adept at doing this, but Greg Abbott, as the governor of Texas, has more money in his political coffers than the entire RNC. So please understand that you have to watch what's going on in Texas because Texas is, to a large extent, now defining the GOP agenda nationally. Now the question is, will that agenda work? God help us, I don't know. I need to sort of share with you what happened the other day. I went to dinner by myself. First of all, I never go out of the house. And I rarely, if ever, go to dinner. But I decided I didn't want to make myself dinner, so I was going to walk downtown. And I went to a little tiny sort of Mexican restaurant where, you get your trays and you move your food back. I'm sitting by myself at a table, and there is a table right next to me of some very well-heeled people. They were talking pretty loud, okay? So not hearing them was next to impossible, and maybe that was intentional. I decided to post what I heard on my Facebook page, because I want to sort of talk a little bit about who we are and where we're going into the future. This is what I wrote. I'm listening to a couple at a table next to me wax poetic about their kid, and apparently their older son was an investment banker who owns two Teslas and has a 2,000 square foot loft in New York City. All right? So I'm listening to them talking, and then I started thinking about my children. And then I started thinking about my youngest daughter. And this is what I wrote. I started thinking of my kid, who works for a nonprofit that provides urgent home repairs for low-income homeowners at no charge. They do things like the construction of mobility ramps, the replacement of roofs, they repair sills, and weatherization of homes. She owns a used car, and after decades of living in the tiniest apartments, finally scored a home. And it made me start thinking, how do we define success? We genuflect to money, be it in politics or life. Just look at Donald Trump. And yet think of the folks that have most influenced your life. This is what I heard sitting in that restaurant, and it really did bring me back to my kids. One's a teacher in a tiny little school. It's an elementary school in one of the most poorest places in all of Vermont. The entire school has 77 students, okay? That's, I think, K through five. And I'm looking at Kirsten, who's working at this place called Cover. From my parents' perspective, they see me as a failure, and they see my children as a failure. Because my parents, they groomed me and they wanted me to be a corporate lawyer, or at least marry one. And of course, I didn't do that. And then I ended up getting involved in politics. And for those of you who don't know, New Hampshire has 400 legislators. Okay, this is a state of 1.3 million. That means every legislator represents a teeny tiny number of people. You know what we get paid? We get paid $100 a year plus mileage. That's it. You don't have your own desk. You don't have your own phone. You don't have, I mean, you get no support. You're on your own, Jack. I ended up running every 2 years for four terms. And I will tell you, everyone, I loved it. I loved it. And I didn't get paid like a California legislator, and I didn't get paid like a New York legislator. But the things I was asked to do, and the hearings that I attended, and what I got to learn was as important and as valuable as them. And I fell in love with the idea of the learning of the policy and understanding the issues of my state. And you may have heard me tell the story a million times. And again, I grieve about what the Republican Party has become today compared to what the Republican Party was when I started running in the New Hampshire legislature. And I will tell this story, and I will tell it over and over again, because you need to know that politics used to be different. Yeah, it had its problems. Yeah, there was money. Yeah, I'm sure there were backdoor deals. And I know that because I saw them. But it wasn't what it is today. What it is today is, it's not that it's even harsh. It's almost feels like it's on the verge of being inhumane. You don't see the other side as the opposition. You see them as the enemy. Something that isn't to be beaten at the polls, but something that's to be destroyed. Destroyed. This is a democracy. We're not going to agree, but we're going to figure out if there are places where we can come to common ideas and common terms. I'm going to use an example. For example, I oppose the death penalty. But you know how we got to repeal the death penalty in New Hampshire? We got to repeal the death penalty in New Hampshire because two groups of people came together that agree on so little. A bunch of liberal Democrats got together with a bunch of libertarian Republicans. And here's what was so interesting. The liberal Democrats didn't believe in the death penalty. Period. They thought it was inhumane, that the government doesn't talk about, murder as being something evil and then committing murder. Okay? They didn't see revenge as a solution. So they've opposed the death penalty. Do you know why the libertarians oppose the death penalty? Because they don't trust government. All right? They didn't want to give government this ultimate power of killing someone because they didn't trust government. And so here you have a group of libertarians and a group of liberals who back into each other for very, very different reasons. But they came to the same solution: repeal the death penalty. Now, I didn't see the libertarians as someone that I saw as the enemy. It was just a group I didn't agree with. And as many of you know, not only do I not see libertarians as the enemy, but my second husband was a Republican libertarian atheist who had never voted for me. I married him. I loved him. So to see politics today the way it is, and to see the rise of fascism, just terrifies me. And again, I want to remind you that the person who asked me to run for the New Hampshire legislature was the former Republican majority leader, who watched me in action for 6 weeks during what we call the Constitutional Convention, where you ran as a citizen, not as a partisan. And at the end of the 6 weeks, I so impressed him with my willingness to listen, to learn, to be curious, to try to work with people I disagreed with. At the end of the 6 weeks, he urged me to run for the New Hampshire legislature, knowing full well that I was a liberal Democrat. But I wasn't evil. I just had a different perspective. And he felt that the state would be improved by having that perspective at the table. Not that it will always win, but that it needed to be heard. I go to when I ran for governor. This I don't think I've ever told you this story. So I run for governor and I win the primary. I'm the first female to win a primary in a major party ticket. I run on very, very liberal positions. I want to change our over-reliance on the property tax. I want to introduce an income tax. I want to create a homestead exemption so that everybody benefits from reduced property taxes. I want to invest in public education because we have such inequitable public investment. I want to sort of improve our healthcare system because I kept going up to the North Country and watching hospitals close because they couldn't survive because no one had access to healthcare. I mean, it was all these things that I was running on. And I was running against John Sununu, Chris Sununu's father, John Sununu's former attorney general. And I was running against a libertarian named Miriam Luce. And Miriam Luce was probably one of the brightest people I'd ever met. And it was a three-way race. The libertarians had actually gotten enough votes years before that they were able to actually qualify to be recognized as a party and that you could vote for a libertarian, a Republican, or a Democrat. So whenever we would have debates, it was always, you know, the three of us. And first of all, Miriam was just so tall. She must have been like 6'1". And in a lot of ways, the Attorney General, Steve Merrill, loved the fact that it would look like it was two girls against one, as if that had ever happened in, you know, New Hampshire history. It had never happened. But Miriam always so impressed me with how she thought. Not that I agreed with her, but how she thought. And I remember about maybe 2 weeks before the election, for a brief instant, I was neck and neck in the polls with Steve Merrill. And there was a chance that I could win the election. And as we were walking out of one of the debates, I pulled her aside and I said, Miriam, I have a question to ask you. And I said, if I become the governor, slim chance, but if I do, would you be willing to consider being my chief of staff? And she looked at me, everyone, like I was a lunatic. Like, what are you talking about, Arnie? And I said, look, I don't agree with you on a lot of things. I agree with you on some, but I agree that you're smart, and I know you have an incredible work ethic, and I know that you have a broad mind and you're willing to sort of listen to a lot of things and then you process. We don't always process the same. I said, but one of the reasons why I would love you to be my chief of staff was that as a liberal Democrat, I don't want to be surrounded by sycophants, number one. And number two, I want someone in the room who will challenge me and say to me, are you sure we need that program? Are you sure we need that policy? Have you played it out? And I want someone who will make me defend what I believe and make me play it out. And you will do that. And I want someone like that close to me, not someone that will hold my hand and agree with me, but someone that who will challenge me. And I really meant that. That was 1992. That was a libertarian. That can't happen today. It just can't. And maybe one of the reasons why I'm sort of grateful that Scott decided that he didn't want to show up today was that I wanted to talk to you a little bit about what happened just the other day. So you know that Chris Sununu had been very critical of Donald Trump, but I knew that criticism was hollow. I knew that he's not a man, frankly, of integrity. I refer to him as my affable political windsock. And I knew that no sooner did Nikki lose the primary that he would quickly come around and support and endorse Donald Trump. And as many of you know, he did exactly that. In fact, George Stephanopoulos had him on for a 9-minute withering interview where he put him on the record. Here's what he wrote. He wrote, it's important to note that Sununu didn't have to go on to the show. If his conscience requires him to vote for Trump, no matter what, Sununu could have done that quietly, in the privacy of his own voting booth. Volunteering to go on TV to promote Donald Trump was a choice. Showing up and then spouting lies on Trump's behalf is another choice. Functionally, Chris Sununu is as active a part of Trump's campaign as Matt Gaetz is, or Marjorie Taylor Greene, or any other MAGA freaks. And it seems not to bother him that these people would basically shoot him as if they would ever give him a second chance. It seems not to bother him that his political career is over. He's not just willing to exit public life on his knees. He appears to be eager to do it. In the end, it doesn't matter if Sununu is a coward or a fool. These characteristics are all pernicious. What matters is that the rest of us understand that it is the Chris Sununus of the world who make this ongoing authoritarian attempt possible. And maybe that's one of the reasons why I want to talk about what it used to be like, when you could agree with a Republican or disagree, that you didn't have to always feel like you needed to walk lockstep with your party, that you could recognize people as being quality or lacking in quality, that you could support a Republican at times and not the Democrat. It didn't mean you were a sellout. It mean you were exercising a choice. But that's not what Sununu was doing. Sununu was being a political whore. And guess what? Attorney Bill Barr has done the same thing. So here was Bill Barr, the former attorney general under Donald Trump, saying the most harsh criticism of Trump about how destructive he would be, or what it would mean if he was elected to a second term. And just in the last 24-48 hours, what did he do? He endorsed and said he will support the entire Republican ticket. Oh my God. Barr, Sununu, they're all coming back to someone they know will be a fascist, to someone they know who's even said he'll be a dictator, to someone who they know who doesn't believe in the exercise of the franchise, because the only vote he believes is a vote where he wins. And if he doesn't win, then it isn't a vote of integrity. Bill Barr, Chris Sununu, these are the Republican leaders who claim to be critics of Donald Trump. And in the end, they were just giving Trump cover. Because frankly, in a lot of ways, this is even more damaging, because they are suggesting that this fascist would be a better choice than Joe Biden. Joe Biden's not my favorite, but Joe Biden won't destroy America. And everyone knows that Trump and the group around him, their goal is not to promote democracy. It's not to recognize that we are a melting pot. It's not to envision a future that needs to address climate change, or a future that needs to figure out how to deal with an aging demographic where healthcare is going to be crucial. Not a future where we need to invest in the public education of all our children, but a future that will marginalize many and basically just, I don't even know what it will look like because I'm so terrified. This, everyone, is the Friday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. We'll be right back with Harold Meyerson and Bill Curry. Stick around.
This is Lincoln Mitchell with today's Mitchell Minute. This week is rich in symbolism in what to expect and how over the course of the election and how the election will be framed over the next 6.5 months. Donald Trump is in a courtroom screaming about the witch hunt, falling asleep, trying to harass the judge, trying to disrupt the trial. And Joe Biden is trying to solve some extremely difficult global problems in an extremely complex world. That is the basic dynamic that will remain in place. Trump's court cases, trials and tribulations are not going away, and the world is not going to get any easier, calmer, or simpler over the next 7 months. And voters will decide based on that. Those who think that Trump is innocent and Biden is making a mess of the world, and that's exactly what the Trump people will try to explain, will obviously vote for Trump. And those who know that Trump is a career criminal who is guilty and that Biden is infinitely better at the helm right now, particularly because of this complicated global situation, will vote for Biden. But the basic dynamic, Biden on the world stage trying to solve problems and Trump in the White House crying about a witch hunt, that is at the core of this election. The Mitchell Minute is a daily minute or so of political analysis from me, Professor Lincoln Mitchell. If you want to hear more of my opinion and analysis, you can subscribe to my YouTube channel at Mitchell Minute or subscribe to my Substack, Kibitzing with Lincoln.
When it's 2019, but it feels like 1933. When your eyes are open, when you know the history, when your parents lived through things that looked so much like this, All the indications impossible to miss when you've sought for your whole life to make the earth a better place. And you once again see the rising of the master race when you know that they are coming, when they announced it in advance, when you know for many people this will be their last chance. Then you may ask the question, what can one person do when the time to act is now? And now it's up to you. When it's 2019, but it feels like 1933, when indefinite detention is the new reality for so many children to whom you did not give birth, when you see they're just as precious as every other child on earth, when they're opening the camps not used since the war, where families were imprisoned decades before, when Kristallnacht is coming, they announced it on the news, when the writing's on the wall, when you can see the fuse, then you may ask the question, what can one person do when the time to act is now? And now it's up to you. When it's 2019, but it feels like 1933, when you know rallies are not helping and silence is complicity, when you know where the kids are kept locked inside their cells, when you see approaching the future this foretells, when they're coming for your neighbors, when they've even said what day they plan to put them all in buses and take them away, when you know where they keep the buses, you've been to the parking lot, perhaps a whole lot of petrol bombs is the best move that you got, then you may ask the question, what can one person do when the time to act is now? And now it's up to you. When it's 2019, but it feels like 1933.
Hey, Scott and Stephanie Collins, you know the drill. We record on Thursday morning. If it is Friday, it must be Bill Curry. He's an American lawyer and politician. He's been a two-time Democratic nominee for the governorship of Connecticut, a White House advisor in the administration of Bill Clinton, and he was the former head of Freeze Voter, a nuclear freeze group. Welcome back to the program, Mr. Curry.
Great to be with you, Arnie.
Harold Meyerson is editor-at-large at the American Prospect and was an opinion columnist for the Washington Post from 2003 until 2015. He served as the executive editor of the LA Weekly from 1989 through 2001. He continues to write about California politics in the LA Times, and you can find his articles at The New Republic, The Nation, New Statesman, yada, yada. But more importantly, I read him and go to him almost every day at the American Prospect. Welcome back, Harold.
Always good to be here, Arnie.
Before both gentlemen came on the air, I said, so what do you want to talk about? And Bill, you said, well, you know, anything's fine, but I think I want to talk about the Supreme Court. And then Harold, you piped in and said, yeah, me too. So Bill, I'm going to have you sort of start the conversation because you said you were been writing notes about the court and not just about what the court was hearing this week, but sort of looking back at sort of this arc of decision making, or maybe lack of decision making. And you even mentioned that you were concerned about the more liberal members of the court. So why don't you sort of introduce the topic for my audience and explain to us what it is that have you concerned?
So as you know, I have repeatedly, to the point of no doubt boring listeners, talked about the fact that I don't really see our democracy being saved in an election, but that it would require the judiciary, which, however compromised it has been in recent decades, may be the least compromised branch of the government, the one most able to step in and save us from a career criminal like Trump becoming president again. And of course, each passing week has made this supposition of mine a little shakier. And now I'm simply without an opinion as to what will happen. And I look at what's happening with this immunity question, the issue that's before them right now. And I just think, first of all, the fact that this hasn't been dismissed out of hand,
yes,
that it's being treated as a credible, a position that one could take under the law of this country, astounds me, that it not only is going to work as a dilatory maneuver, as just a way of putting off the judgment, that surprises me. But it surprises me even more that some people are seriously considering it. I thought that apart from Clarence Thomas and Alito, that no one would. And that's not at all clear. And I just want to just say, I look back on these last few months, the last year, and I look at the performance, not just of the radical Republicans in the court, but of the whole court, including the establishment Democrats who were there. I look at their performance on the ethics issue. Years and years of delay and rationalization, followed finally by the adoption of an unenforceable code, with the Democratic appointees signing off basically in silence about it. I'm just heartbroken to see that. I look at the Colorado case. I was reminded of the arguments about chaos that persuaded Sandra Day O'Connor to vote the wrong way on Bush v. Gore. And I listened to all the rhetoric, including from people on our side, about the chaos that would result from the Supreme Court resolving that issue in that case. What is an insurrection? Does an insurrection include a coup? I think so. Does an office of the federal government include the presidency? Anyone would think so. And the idea that this is the only constitutional provision that is inoperative unless the Congress passes enabling legislation, all these ideas that my life in the law, and I did have many years of it, would have told me were simply beyond the pale.
Right.
Being taken, not only being taken seriously, but driving the result in the Colorado decision, that was for the court. That was a per curiam. Everybody signed on to the result. And so I look at this and I think, you look at Colorado, you look at the ethics, you look at obstruction. I'll just stop with those. There are others. There's a crisis here, and it goes beyond just the Republicans.
How would you like to weigh in, Harold? Because I want to go back again to what Bill had said to me the other night. We were talking about the Colorado case and, you know, the idea that it would cause chaos because, you know, each state would take a position. But I thought the Supreme Court was being asked not just to really about Colorado, but to settle the case for all 50 states. It's kind of like, you know, it's almost the opposite of what happened with Dobbs. Roe v. Wade was wonderful. It set the stage. What has Dobbs done? It has created chaos because it sent it back to the states. What you suddenly realize is you go to the Supreme Court because you want something to be decided not state by state, but you want them to make a decision for a nation, which is really what the Colorado case was ostensibly about. It wasn't just about Colorado. But as you point out, Bill, they all signed on. They all signed on, including the three liberals. So, Harold, how are you looking at this court? Because, I mean, it has got the lowest approval rating of any court probably in American history right now for the Supreme Court. And yet at the same time, I feel like maybe the three liberals have been dulled by their presence with the rest of the conservatives on the bench. They've been lulled into sort of agreeing with things that if they had been put into isolation, they never would have.
Well, I don't really feel capable of judging the liberals' mindset and motivations. I think Bill has suggested, you know, that you would think that certain cases that would make them, you know, just erupt and be obstreperous.
Exactly.
That hasn't happened. I think if you look at what former Justice Stephen Breyer is still writing saying, that Stephen Breyer, we can say, has been lulled, to use your word. I think the jury is still out, but the fact that it's still out on the three sitting liberal justices is not clear. This week's hearing on whether it was an obstruction of justice for the January 6th rioters / insurrectionists to come essentially to halt what may be, you know, the single most weighty day in Congress's history when it goes through what should be a pro forma, a day of ratifying the Electoral College verdict, you know, just was mind boggling in terms of the sheer dismissal of, you should forgive me for using this phrase, common sense, as to what the Constitution said about this and what the law was about this. I would add that Dobbs really was the court's Dred Scott moment. What the Dred Scott case did, beyond just saying Black people could never be viewed as citizens of the United States, was it undid the sort of modus vivendi by which the United States had continued to exist. The Missouri Compromise, or the Kansas-Nebraska Act, these political compromises, dreadful as some of them were, worked out. You know, when you suddenly remove that, the Civil War became a very likely possibility. Well, you know, striking down Roe, which had been the law for half a century, you know, was just as destabilizing. And I think that was beyond, you know, just the outrage of that decision. You know, it really seriously suggested a court like the Roger Taney Court of 1857 had gone off the rails in terms of actually what it thought its scope and power was in the entire American system, both of government and of, as in the case of Dred Scott, the modus vivendi. This is how we get along. You don't take away people's rights that have been there for 50 years unless there's something really disturbing in the minds of the justices.
What they've opened the door for, though, is Bill Curry, and I put this out there. It feels like the Republican Party, especially the conservatives on the bench, are inviting us to look back and not to look ahead, not to look at what we've done to sort of change this nation, to expand rights, to invite more people in, to understand things like, you know, the right of privacy. And I wrote this down the other day, that the Republicans love the Arizona 160-year-old law banning abortion. They love the 151-year-old Comstock chastity law. But then they look at Joe Biden, they say, but Joe Biden is 81 and too old. And yet, look what they're doing. They're inviting everyone. I mean, not only, you keep talking about 50 years with Dobbs. I'm looking at 50 years going, oh, those are youngsters. Let's go 160 years and look what they're doing in Arizona. It is so terrifying to understand that we are not being driven back by decades. We're being driven back by centuries, you know, and what Dobbs did was an invitation for this kind of thing that's happening in Arizona. And even though people are apoplectic in Arizona about the 160-year-old law that they're going back to, the Arizona GOP can't even address the issue. They don't even know what they think, Bill. You know, they've been so anti-abortion for so long that suddenly when they realize the consequences of it, they don't even have the language or the mindset to figure out what to do next.
Hey, Harold, did you want to jump in there?
I wrote a quick little piece. I did some digging around about the 1864 Arizona law. I basically found this. There was no census in Arizona until 1870.
Okay.
But the census showed that the population of the state, not counting Native Americans, was about 9,000 people. And this was 6 years before that, during the Civil War, when a number, you know, A, women could not vote, B, a substantial portion of the state was still aligned with the Confederacy and would not have taken part in this election. I think it's quite possible that the actual number of voters in Arizona who elected the legislature that adopted this language was only slightly higher than 1,000 people, all white men, I should add. The Speaker of the House that passed this fled to Mexico during the Civil War because the Union Army had gotten on to his pro-Confederate leanings, and only a few months before he became Speaker, came back and took an oath of office. And the actual language of the abortion ban was one part of a 400-page, here's a compendium of laws we should adopt, that was taken from another state. It's not at all clear that the abortion part of that 400 pages even was subject to debate. I mean, you know, they couldn't go through everything in the relatively few days they were in session. So, minuscule electorate, not yet a state, political sensibilities of the legislature, very unclear as to which side of the Civil War they were on and so forth. You know, and this is the law which the Arizona Supreme Court has now enshrined as still in effect.
Oh my God, Bill. 9,000 people, huh?
Probably about 7,000 at the time of 1864 when this territorial legislature first convened.
And then remember, only white men could vote anyway. So take that. That 7,000 included women and children and,
yeah.
You know, that part of the story I was not aware of. That information is so crucial as we talk about what they do, because when we think about laws, we're generic. We think about a state. We don't think about a territory. We don't think about the 9,000. You know, we hear a lot about, well, women didn't even have the right to vote. There was only 9,000 people. That's not even the size of a small town. I mean, it's just, as you dig deeper and deeper, it gets more and more insidious and more evil what they're doing. But what is more shocking, Bill, is that they brought it up twice now, and the Republicans can't move forward on it. That's the part that is so shocking. And they know that probably less than 10% of the current Arizona population even approve of this.
One parenthetical response to this, and then an observation about the larger picture. And the parenthetical response is, we'd all be better off. Especially those of us who are progressives and want to tell the public that it should entrust the government with more responsibilities to establish a better life. It's up to us to make sure the government really runs better than it does.
Yes.
And we should be more interested in those issues. When I was a young state senator, I was involved in a law revision commission. And our dull job was to go over all these decrepit, unused statutes, you know, and there really ought to be a legal principle that if something, if there's a law that's been on the books for 200 years without anyone citing it, that was established under such questionable circumstances, it ought not to have a presumption of being, of continuing to be operant. There are serious equity issues to raise here, and we don't have a philosophy about it, but we also just should have a law revision commissions in every one of these states doing things like, we ought to be taking this stuff more seriously and getting more involved in the day-to-day operations and sometimes in the minutia of government to be cleaning stuff like this up. I just want to say lastly that what the Republicans are doing, but what the Democrats in the kinds of establishment Democrats who we've ended up appointing to the Supreme Court for a variety of understandable reasons are caught up in a kind of centrist ideology. When Anthony Kennedy did Citizens United, he wasn't speaking for the extreme Republicans. He was speaking for all of Washington and their willingness to see that the kinds of campaign finance, the money in politics, the lobbying, the career opportunities for cooperative government officials, that it was all okay. And the Democrats believed it almost as much as the Republicans did. And I look at some of these questions about immunity and about obstruction and about Colorado and the 14th Amendment and about ethics. And I just see people on all sides picking and choosing precedents, ignoring plain language, even plain constitutional language, really writing decisions that reflect the prejudices of the powerful more than they reflect the underlying constitutional law. And it's true for Elena Kagan. And it's true for all of our own appointees. Good people doing good things on lots of issues, but on fundamental issues of the workings of this democracy and of the accountability of corporations, on the fundamental issues of the distribution of wealth, income, power, and opportunity, they are letting us down. And we as progressive-minded people need to spend more time drawing attention to that and asking for more of our own appointees. These people aren't doing the job on our side. There's two or three of those things we've named that they never should have gone along with, but they did. It's time to get upset about it.
I wanted to talk a little bit, since I talk about disappointment and our elected officials, I want to talk a little bit about Mayor Eric Adams. I saw this story and I'm like, oh my God, this is impossible. Mayor Adams is pushing to hire an ex-Giuliani deputy as New York's top lawyer. All right. And of course, now I did a follow-up story that he's facing backlash on the city council. I'm like, what is going on here? Like, this is ostensibly on paper. Mayor Adams is supposedly a Democrat. Mm-hmm. But I'm looking at all the stuff that's swirling around him. I'm looking at how he's operating. I'm looking at New York City. And I keep wondering, you know, New York City allowed Donald Trump to get away with basically any form of corruption you could possibly imagine for decades. They never threw the book at him. And as a result of not doing that, look at where he is. And then I read these stories about Mayor Adams and I'm thinking, God, New York City is such a freaking swamp. I'm just appalled, Harold. This story, especially happening now, as Donald Trump is sitting in a courtroom in New York City, and then you see what Mayor Adams wants to do by hiring this ex-Giuliani, ex-deputy as his legal counsel, and you're thinking, this can't be real. Is anyone reading the political landscape here? But apparently, maybe I'm the naive one, and they know what's going on, because I sure as hell don't, Harold.
I was looking at the absurd system by which New Jersey primary elections were conducted, which finally is
changed.
On the way out. And one of the conclusions I reached, because when you look at in the Northeast, in Northeastern states, not so much yours, Arnie, but in Massachusetts, in New York, in New Jersey, the vestiges and folkways of the old political machines have had this, you know, half-life, which have been a real problem. And what, Eric Adams is really sort of a you know, someone who comes out of that school, you know, and was elected, you know, who rose through the ranks first of the police department, then of the official Democratic clubs of Brooklyn. And that plus the combination of a, you know, kind of people voting their ethnicity is what enabled him to become mayor. But I mean, he was initially a Republican. He still has, you know, vestiges of a almost a Frank Rizzo mentality that he has schlepped into Gracie Mansion. Most New Yorkers at this juncture pleased with his tenure? No, they're not. And, you know, there is on the city council a real solid block of progressives who sort of are in the AOC school of political thought. But there Adams is, and is kind of, in, you know, he brings his own form of cluelessness, I think, to the mayorality, which seems, his cluelessness seems to have informed much of his tenure as mayor.
Well, I keep thinking that Donald Trump keeps saying this is such a Democratic city, and I'm going, no, it was Giuliani's city, and apparently it's still Giuliani's city, Bill. It's like, well, wait a minute, this will undermine what Donald Trump is saying, because, you know, he keeps saying, how do you trust these New York voters? How do you trust New York? You know what they're going to do? And I'm thinking, well, Mayor Adams just gave you cover, honey bun, because guess what? He says, ah, Giuliani, he's perfectly fine, and look at us, we're part of that corruption team. It's just, again, I feel like at the political moment that Adams is doing this, I'm like, I'm hitting my head going, what the H? And yet it's happening in clear view. It's just shocking to me.
First of all, I want to thank Harold for reminding us all of Frank Rizzo.
yeah, we needed that,
the,
didn't
the
we?
The famous skull-bashing, corruption-courting mayor of Philadelphia. And I would like to say that the only thing that Eric Adams lacks in order to obtain true Frank Rizzo status is opportunity. I wouldn't be surprised if he finds it. That Eric Adams is the mayor of New York on every level is just an outrage. This guy has no leadership abilities that are germane to the problems facing this city. He is on his face, at least he is guilty of the kind of soft corruption that Anthony Kennedy in that Citizens United case said was okay. That's at the very least. And I'll point out two things, a couple of things about Randy Master, who's apparently a fairly talented lawyer. And that's the end of what you can say about him that's positive. He is currently representing the benighted Phil Murphy of New Jersey in challenging New York's congestion pricing policy. Now, I guess he'll drop Murphy as a client if he takes this job. But I wonder how vigorously he will be defending the policy that he was just, you know, this month in court opposing. And the second thing I would point out is that he's being hired to be the city's top lawyer. But really, as long as we're talking about soft corruption, he's being hired to defend Eric Adams against charges of corruption.
Exactly.
That's
exactly
why he's being offered the job. Ugh. And because he's done so well with other obviously corrupt people. And by the way, he wasn't, people in a couple reports talked about him as having been Giuliani's lawyer. He was on the staff. He was on the city hall staff.
He was the deputy mayor.
As part of the Giuliani administration, one of the deputy mayors. And so you're just taking a guy who's, you know, whose whole past begs any Democrat, but any sincerely ethical person concerned with the efficient operation of government, not to hire him. And you're putting him into arguably the second most important position in city government. It's just awful. He has every conflict imaginable. He shouldn't be in this position. And it tells you everything you need to know about Eric Adams, that he's moved in this direction.
I want to just touch base before I let both of you go to the what happened in New Jersey, because I think that's really important as well. And yet I want to remind everyone, but Donald Trump is going to bring in fascism. And that doesn't mean that we have perfect democracy. We have a very we have a democracy that needs a lot of repair. A lot of repair. And yet I will embrace that flawed democracy over a fascist agenda that you see right now with the Republican Party. But talk a little bit really quickly, Harold, about the county line voting in New Jersey's Democratic primaries. I think I was so shocked to even realize that there was such a thing that existed. I think it only exists in New Jersey, nowhere else in the country, but it sets it up for the machine. It doesn't set it up for the voters. And the fact that it's basically being blocked is really a celebration of democracy, but it's hundreds of years. Like, how could this still exist, Harold? Oh my God.
Well, yeah, but this is of a piece with the fact that, you know, there's still this clubhouse culture in the Democratic Party in New York. Yes. In New Jersey, they see some of it in Massachusetts, which is great for party hacks. And what New Jersey was essentially each county could structure its ballot so that its approved primary candidate would be like listed right at the top of the ballot. And you'd have to go searching elsewhere, even though it's the same race for the same position, for the candidates that the county decided it didn't want. Well, Andy Kim, who's a Congress member from Jersey, is running for the Senate for the Bob Menendez seat. Parentheses, I see Bob Menendez has now said, oh, it's all my
it's
wife.
It's his wife. It's his wife. That's right.
Yeah.
Claiming her.
Right. Andy Kim went to court.
The trouble in paradise.
Building on a case that had been filed some time ago by the Working Families Party. God bless it. To get rid of this ridiculous, archaic, old clubhouse, the boss decides system. And, you know, they're prevailing. But, you know, the fact that this vestige of Tammany Hall politics cooked up in about 1867, you know, it goes back as far as the Arizona abortion law. This is zombies still walking among us. The ghost of Tammany. The ghost of a state that had fewer than 9,000 residents, somehow they haunt us still.
It's an amazing thing. And again, I want to remind anyone that this county line voting does not exist in any other state in the United States. Not only is it a vestige.
Although a number of states, as Harold said, have things like this. I just want to say, if you look at your nominating process, that it resembles nothing more than a game of chutes and ladders.
Yeah,
just be sure that you understand it's not an accident. It was set up that way.
And that note, shoots and ladders. What a way to end the show. Bill Curry, an American lawyer and politician, two-time Democratic nominee for the governorship of Connecticut. And Harold Meyerson is the editor at large at the American Prospect. Thank you very much for joining us. Shoots and ladders. This is the Friday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. We'll schmooze on Monday, everyone. Ciao. You bet. Change.